It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. In today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the worst seems to be over in the recent avian flu outbreak. We'll take a look at efforts to prevent similar problems in the future.
First, Dylan Roof has confessed to authorities that he is responsible for shooting and killing 9 members of a prayer meeting at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston on Wednesday night. According to investigators, he told them that he intended to start a race war.
It became apparent Thursday that racism was a motivation behind the attack when a witness reported Roof saying, "I have to do it. You rape our women and you're taking over our country and you have to go," end quote. A Facebook picture also showed him wearing flags from apartheid-era South Africa and Rhodesia.
Some have been hesitant to characterize the attack as racist. Presidential hopeful Jeb Bush told a crowd this morning, "I don't know what was on the mind or the heart of the man who committed these atrocious crimes." But other commentators have been more clear, with some calling for South Carolina to take down the Confederate flag that flies at its capital. Here with us to talk about the racism at play in this attack is Carsonia Wise Whitehead, Associate Professor of Communication and African American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. She's the author of Notes from a Colored Girl and Letters to My Black Sons. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
So initially, it sounds like there was some reluctance to call this a racist attack. And now that the shooter has been quoted as saying that he intended to start a race war, is it fair to call this shooting racist?
I think it is fair to call it a racially motivated attack. I thought it was fair when it first happened. The fact that this was a particular church that he chose, one that had a long history of African-American activism, this is one of the oldest black churches in America, and definitely the oldest one in the South, south of Baltimore. The fact that he allegedly made comments about his feelings around people of color, where, you know, "I have to do this, and you rape our women, you're taking our country, taking over our country, and you have to go." It was racially motivated from the core, and my concern is with the media hesitating about doing this and about calling it exactly what it was, a racially motivated domestic terrorist act.
And that has been another point of contention about whether we call this terrorism or not. Why do you think this qualifies as terrorism?
Well, one of the hearts was, I've been doing a lot of research thinking about this notion of terrorism and the reluctance to call it a terrorist act, that there's something about striking fear and terror into the hearts and minds of citizens of a particular area. That when I speak to my family and friends in Charleston, South Carolina, there is a fear of the church being a safe space. There's a fear of being in a community of black people. There is terror that has been struck in their hearts. And he made a deliberate attack to attack the fear of minds of the people who were there, and that is what he did do. And that is why I think it should be called domestic terrorism. I know there's a reluctance to do that because they talk about terrorism as it pertains to a different site, that it has to be a building or something that represents something to a nation. But I think there's another type of terrorism that we should talk about, one that is heavily steeped in this issue of race that we are really obsessed with in this country.
What do you think changes if we do allow the shooter to be referred to as a terrorist? What changes in the way that we frame this issue then?
Perhaps we're sending a message that this type of activity, this type of action, this type of mindset will not be tolerated in a nation that is trying to move itself forward. Will we consider ourselves to be a nation that is steeped in diversity, a nation that is about becoming better than what we used to be, a nation that is about making better choices? And perhaps the first way we can do this is calling these type of acts, when you target a particular community, it is an act of domestic terror. He killed 9 people. He has terrorized 9 families. And then there's a ripple effect. The people who are part of that church, the people who are in that community, the people who are in that city. I have my own 12-year-old son asking me, "Is it safe to go to church anymore?" But this is having a long-reaching impact.
We're talking right now to Carsonia Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communication and African American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, talking about Wednesday's shooting at a black church in Charleston. And Carsonia, you grew up in South Carolina. What is your sense of the state of race relations there?
Well, I was born in Columbia, and I grew up with my parents between Columbia and Lexington, South Carolina, and Washington, D.C. And growing up, back and forth between the two, I was always struck by how behind I felt that South Carolina was in terms of race relations. I mean, the first time I was called an N-word at the age of 8, it happened in South Carolina. The first time I was kicked out of a store because the owner says I don't have to sell to colored people, I think I was 9. It happened in Ola, South Carolina. The first time I realized that the Klan was real and that they worked in the community where I lived, I was 10 years old. It was in Lexington, South Carolina. I mean, I pulled out my diaries where I talk about my summers in South Carolina and being called the Yankee N-word and being told that the South will rise again. Having my nana tell me there are people in the community I couldn't play with that were white because they flew the Confederate flag off their porch. So race relations have always been very, very tense in the South. It is not made any better by the decision to have the Confederate flag there. It is not made any better because of the situation that's happening now between, you know, this one gentleman that, of course, marks this idea that there's a race war that he wants to start that is brewing and that's above him. South Carolina is a hotbed, and not just South Carolina, because you can extend out towards the South in terms of the ways in which black and white people are wrestling with this issue of race.
Well, I was going to say, as far as you can tell, against that background, the backdrop you just described and also the national conversation that we've been having about race, do you think this shooting is seen as a blip on the radar, a lone wolf shooter, or is more symptomatic of unsettled race issues in America?
I think it's the latter rather than the former. I don't think it's a lone wolf theory. I think that within the black community that we have been dealing with the struggle since the Trayvon Martin incident. I mark that kind of as the unofficial beginning because that's the first time that we saw Twitter and Facebook begin to kind of catalog these incidences, that we feel that we have to remind the world, starting with America first, that black lives matter, that we have to say it, we have to claim it, we have to march about it, we have to preach about it, because if we don't, then people don't tend to recognize it. I think this incident, along with the Rachel Dolezal incident that happened earlier this week, speak to a bigger discussion that we need to essentially have in this country. Where do we stand on the issue of race, and how do we settle this issue? Not just in the hearts and minds of older people, but in the hearts and minds of people the age of Dylan Storm Ruth and younger. He's 21 years old. Who taught him that people have taken his country away from him? This is not something he grew up with. This is something he learned from someone.
Who do you think he learned it from?
Well, outside of his family members, which I think we should investigate, I wonder about the media. I mean, this idea that, you know, we need to take our country back, I mean, we've been hearing this from the Tea Party for quite a long time now. We've had one gentleman who's now running for president who is trying to convince us that our current president is not one of us. He's not from here. I mean, the rhetoric that we are using about who the country belongs to speaks to this big point of tension around race, as if black people don't belong in this country, and as if the country doesn't belong to us just as much as it belongs to white people. So that is a huge concern that I think we have to get to the bottom of.
Now, a couple of moments ago, you mentioned the Confederate flag, and the Confederate flag was flying at full staff in front of the Capitol building in South Carolina yesterday, and the suspect apparently has Confederate flag vanity plates on his car. How would you say that the flag and its symbolism is seen by different groups in South Carolina today?
Well, the Confederate flag is a symbol for black people, and anyone who understands American history is seen as a symbol of oppression. It is seen as a symbol of racial discord. I mean, it's this notion that you have, you know, 11 to 13 states that were willing to rip the nation in half rather than let people free. I mean, I know the Confederate flag did not fly at half mast today, but I also understand that you need a legislative vote for that to happen, that it's not attached to a pulley, but it's attached to the top of the pole. But when that flag is there and when black people see that flag, you get a big concern because that flag marks where the nation stands in terms of race relations. But you also have people in South Carolina who call it the war of northern aggression rather than the Civil War, who talk about the South rising again as if the South rising again means that things will go back to the way they used to be, as if this didn't happen 150 years ago and the nation hasn't changed in significant ways since then.
Now, supporters of being allowed to fly the Confederate flag say that it stands for heritage, not hate. What do you say to that?
I absolutely disagree. I think that if you're talking about individuals, I think individuals have the right to fly whatever they want to fly off their porch if they want to, you know, have vanity plates. But when it comes to a state making that type of statement, that is where my concern is. I can wear any type of Black Lives Matter t-shirt that I want to wear, and you don't have to agree with it. But if the Black Lives Matter t-shirt became a flag and Maryland adopted that as their national flag, their national symbol, then I think we have a bigger issue. And that is why I wrestle with the Confederate flag, not for individuals who paint it on the side of their houses and who paint it on the sides of their cars. It's when the state itself has made this their national symbol and stands by it. That is my concern about what message does it send to its residents in South Carolina and then to the rest of the country and then ultimately to the rest of the world.
And Kersonia, just briefly, as we wrap up, what can people who weren't involved in the attack, people who aren't African-American, do to be allies in this situation?
Well, I think that there are two big things I think about. One is that the Mother Emanuel AME Church has set up a fund to help offset the funeral costs for the families that were affected, a fund to help repair the church with the damage that was done during the gunfire, a fund to help set up for counselors for those that were traumatized, from the 5-year-old girl who played dead to the 80-year-old members who were there who were laying down as well. That is one way that you can kind of use your pocketbook to help. But another way is to be that ally in the room. If you are the only white person in the room, and situations are being discussed, are you able to speak up no matter who's in the room? If there are no black people in the room and racist jokes are made or racist policies are discussed, can you stand up and speak for what is right and be able to do that? It's not enough to be my ally and to march with me when I'm there, but can you stand for me when I am not there? And I think that people should begin by questioning themselves. I hold myself accountable. I think about things. I look at the ways in which I process things. I understand I've been socialized in America, and I try to hold myself to a different standard. So when I think those type of stereotypical thoughts, when I tend to act in stereotypical ways, I challenge myself to be better. So start to be an ally means starting with yourself and then going beyond there.
Kersonia, thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate you having me on the show.
We've been speaking with Kersonia Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communication at Loyola University, Maryland, about Wednesday's shooting at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina.
This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
This spring's outbreak of avian flu caused some big problems for poultry and egg operations here in Wisconsin and around the Midwest. Over 1.8 million chickens and turkeys were destroyed in Wisconsin because of that virus, and quarantines were set up in affected areas.
The last of the state's quarantines ended last week, but state officials are calling on owners of flocks, large and small, to be on the lookout for continued infection. And the USDA is raising concerns about lapses in biosecurity that could have helped the disease spread.
John Brinquell joins us now for a look at that outbreak and efforts to prevent the next one. He's the CEO of Egg Innovations, which is a free-range egg producer with operations around the Midwest, including 11 farms in Wisconsin. John, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
Now, John, it sounds like the worst of the avian flu outbreak is behind us now. What's the latest news from inside the industry?
We believe that the worst is behind us, but we are still seeing infections this week. Another 1.1 million birds was announced in Iowa. We're still seeing some legacy infections in the turkey industry, but relative to May and early June, we do not have nearly the magnitude of announcements that we were having a couple weeks ago.
Now the numbers, I mean, even the ones you just made, but they sound really huge. I mean, 1.8 million birds destroyed in Wisconsin alone. Have we ever seen anything like this before?
The last time we had avian influenza in the United States was in the mid-'80s in Pennsylvania. What is unique about this strain and this time around is it appears that it was started by wildfowl. However, as the epidemiology reports, which is kind of the trace back of what went on, what we found is once we had the first infection, among other things, we as an industry did, unfortunately, a very good job of spreading it around ourselves to industry partners as we traded the product.
How did you do that, though?
What happens is, you know, the disease is very stable, especially in summer, spring and fall when it's cool weather. And it's things like two different companies. One would have an infected farm and one would have a clean farm, but they shared workers. And
oh, okay.
So on the bottoms of their shoes and on their clothes, trucks were driving onto properties that might have had the disease on their tires. And so we were not on the top of our game biosecurity-wise early in the infection stage.
Now, you know, you said that, that some of this was spread by, did you say wildfowl? Is that what you said?
Yeah, the one of the common vectors is wildfowl that are, exactly, waterborne fowl or not, waterfowl such as geese and ducks, they can carry a natural immunity to it. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at the flyways across the United States, there's three or four, and when birds migrate in great numbers in spring and fall, this infection, if you watch it, was dominantly along the Mississippi flyway.
Oh, okay. Now, how bad was this in Wisconsin as compared to other states in the region? I know Minnesota dealt with it quite a bit too, right?
Speaking for the egg industry, we had two significant situations, both in Jefferson County. We had a couple hundred thousand birds that was a confined cage-free operation, and then we had a larger caged operation, but that was the limit of Wisconsin commercial infections.
Okay, so it wasn't quite as bad as some other areas then, is that what you're saying?
Correct. The area that got, from the egg industry perspective, the area that got devastated the most was Iowa.
Okay. Now, you kind of alluded to this a little bit, but what kind of measures do you have in place to try to stop the spread? Is it basically people taking their shoes off and putting different shoes on when they go from place to place, or are there other things?
There's a wide variety of things. Obviously, the first things we do is we simply limit traffic. And speaking for our company, one of the things that we were surprised by was the amount of traffic we had on our farms that we were not fully aware of, such as salesmen. And they might be visiting an individual farm, and then they, get in their car and drive down the street to the next farm. And so that was one of the things we had to get better at. But in our company, we do things such as when we trade eggs among partners, we only use one-way materials that don't come back to us. We certainly, anytime we enter facilities, we put on single-use disposable garments. All of our cars and trucks go through washes and sanitations in between every visit. So
is this how it's always been in the egg business? Have you always had to wear decontamination suits like this and stuff, or is that something new?
We operated as an industry, we were always, if you would have talked to any of us in the industry, we were always proud of what we did for biosecurity. But this round of avian influenza really forced us to raise our game and pointed out to weaknesses in our system. So, for instance, in our company, even after this disease subsides, which it will, when we lower our biosecurity protocols, they will never return back to where they were in January and February this year. They will remain at an elevated level just because we're smarter now.
Right. So this could very likely affect people in their pocketbooks. I mean, what do you think this is going to do for egg prices?
Well, we've seen, I think anyone who's been in the grocery store the last 21 days has seen it. What we've seen is a very rapid rise in the price of eggs for the summer, and we do believe that has peaked, and in some cases is now softening. The unknown factor is when we go into the fourth quarter, which is a typical heavy demand period because of Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Right.
But for the summer, I think we've seen the highs, and in my opinion, we would expect a little bit of retracement. They won't go back down to where they were in spring, but I think they'll come off the levels they are right now.
Mm-hmm. Now your company focuses in free-range eggs. Is that true?
Correct. We produce ethical eggs, which means all of our eggs are either free-range or pasture. And so that's been a challenge for us because we're very passionate about our birds going outside in good weather. However, because Wisconsin has a state of emergency which hasn't been officially lifted, we have to keep them confined until that state of emergency is lifted.
Now, is it true though that free range chickens are a little bit less susceptible to this, or is that some nonsense I read somewhere?
I'm not going to speak specifically to avian influenza, but we certainly believe and have premised our company on, when, just like children, when you get birds outside and you let them engage in natural behavior and you give them access to nature, they do build up a stronger immunity than when you leave a bird confined in a cage. The analogy I always give people that they can understand It's why the people in Mexico can drink the water and we can't. It's because they've built up a tolerance.
Right, right. Now, you kind of mentioned that in your case and probably in the case of a lot of other companies, they're going to be doing business a little differently and be a little more careful. What other changes do you think could happen in response to this outbreak? Do you think there could be more free-range eggs out there?
You know, certainly we believe that would be a step in the right direction. The other thing that is going to be a long-term debate in the industry is we as an industry built some mammoth egg operations where you might have as many as 5 million birds on a farm. And I think this is going to have a fairly open discussion on how concentrated should you allow agricultural operations to get. Because in the case of our company, we have them very diversified. Our typical family farmer has 20,000 birds, and I have 60 of them. So if I would have gotten AI, which I didn't, fortunately, mm-hmm. it would have been one individual farm out of 60 and 1.5% of my production. In the case of Iowa, you know, we had farms that had 5 million birds on one farm.
Wow. All right. Well, John, thanks for joining us today. That was John Brunquell. He's CEO of Egg Innovations, looking at last year's avian flu outbreak.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Mike Arnold. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Summer is the best time in Wisconsin for local food lovers. Every week there's something new to experiment with at the farmers market.
And one ingredient that they can really enhance some of those fresh summer flavors with is garlic. And on this Food Friday, we have Lori Skelton with us talking about different ways to incorporate garlic into your summer cooking.
And we're taking your calls on garlic, too. What's your favorite way to use garlic in summer recipes? You ever use garlic in sweet recipes like Lori did? What's your favorite garlicky dish? You can call in, share your recipes and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton's one of WPR's in-house foodies and a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Now, what inspired you to spend the last few weeks cooking with garlic?
I made a mistake a couple of months ago. Somebody called in a few months ago and was asking about garlic scape pesto. And I had just pulled the first green garlic out of my garden, and I was so excited about it, I got the green garlic mixed up with scapes. Green garlic are those first new plants of garlic that you have to pull out of the ground. You have to thin out of your garlic patch after they've wintered over. What garlic scapes are, it's the actual flower of the garlic plant. It's a firmer stalk than green garlic. Green garlic is going to taste more like a green onion, although with a little sharper flavor. Garlic scapes, you need to trim those off of your plants.
And do they taste like garlic?
They do taste like garlic. Huh. They taste like a very bright flavor of garlic. It's a firmer stem, if you will, and it makes it really great for making pesto because of that firmer texture. You can also chop it up into salads or use the whole stalk as a garnish for your Bloody Mary.
Can you get that at the store, though? I mean, I don't really
very
often.
I am seeing them.
Not that I'm looking for garlic much. But
I am seeing them in a few stores, and they're all over the farmers markets right now.
Oh,
if you know anyone with garlic plants, they may be looking to get rid of some. So they're out there. You just have to ask.
Okay.
So did you cook with all that stuff this time around? The scapes, the bulbs, and the green garlic? Did you really garlic it up with all the different varieties?
I had to be a little bit careful because I'm singing Carmina Burana with the Milwaukee Symphony Chorus tonight. So I couldn't go too overboard. But yes, I did. Green garlic, garlic scapes, and whole garlic in so many different ways. Whole garlic cloves, and in some cases, whole heads of garlic made it into the experiment, which is not a problem for me. I love using garlic. But it was nice to focus on how do you use it specifically for summer recipes? How do you use garlic to play up some of summer's distinctive flavors?
Now, why do you think garlic's good for summer stuff? I mean, is it because everybody's outdoors and it doesn't stink the whole place up, or what?
That is a part of it. And I'm sorry to say, the old wives' tale about if you eat garlic, you won't get bitten by mosquitoes, that is not true. I wish it were. I'd be so good if it were. I think one of the lovely things about it is, as I discovered, garlic is very versatile. There's a lot of ways you can work with it. And what I really enjoyed about garlic recipes in the summer. There are a lot of things that show up at this time of year that are cool and wet. Tomatoes, cucumbers, mm-hmm. honeydew melon, and for some reason, garlic...
honeydew melon and garlic. I'm sorry. I'm
just
stopping right
well,
there.
Think about it. You very often can make a gazpacho, a cold soup, with tomatoes or with cucumbers and greens, or sometimes with a base of melon.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, throw in some garlic. Garlic scapes are great in soups. Chop up some of those scapes. And so if you're doing a gazpacho with honeydew, yes, garlic would be wonderful. And that's what one of the things I discovered that I really didn't know. There's something about the sharpness of garlic that really plays well with summer cool, wet ingredients.
Right, I need to get more adventurous with this because I think garlic and I think tomatoes, and then my mind stops. Tomatoes. But you've got so many other things, and one area you're looking at is condiments, where you could, maybe that's a good way to dip your toe in the garlic pool and try some new things. Just what you can dip stuff in. What kinds of condiments do you use it with?
Most of us have roasted garlic in the oven. But think about the grills going. Toss some garlic cloves with a little olive oil, maybe a little bit of water to keep them from burning. Wrap them up in a packet of foil. Throw that on your grill, and then you've got that to spread on your hamburger buns, or perhaps, dare I say it, your bratwurst.
Whoa.
Garlic bratwurst.
Garlic bratwurst.
If you roast a couple of heads of garlic, that'll keep in the refrigerator for a couple of days, especially if you put a little olive oil in with it. You can also pickle garlic cloves. And we all love pickles in the summer. It's that lovely little tart zing on the plate with everything else. Pickled garlic is so much fun to play with. You work with a clear vinegar brine, real simple, white vinegar, red vinegar, cider vinegar, and you can either use just a plain herb. I like thyme or savory, or you can get a little creative with mustard seeds and fennel seeds. But a quick pickle of garlic, again, you can keep that in the refrigerator. You don't have to worry about canning it, but chop it up and throw it wherever you want. Throw it in your coleslaw.
Mm-hmm.
Throw it onto an antipasto platter. You know, have it something to just nibble with. Chop it up in your hummus would be another good one.
That's a cool idea.
And so there's pickling, there's roasting, and then there's what is known as confit, where you cook something low and slow. You're basically poaching it in oil, and then you store it in the oil you've cooked it in. And garlic is great for that, whether you're using straight olive oil or you've got some herbs with it. You can also make a confit with garlic and firmer vegetables like fennel and lemon are great, cooked, again, low and slow, poached in oil, and then put in the food processor, blitz just a little bit, and then you've got this lovely, chunky, savory condiment. It's great on grilled chicken, great on grilled fish.
Oh, that sounds very good.
Yeah.
That's great. So that's what confit is. It's sort of like a...
Anytime you cook something in fat and then store it in the fat you cooked it in, that's confit. We think about duck leg confit, but you can do other things.
I don't. But some people do, I guess.
That's a classic. Huh. A classic French dish.
Yes,
is
I've
you
heard
preserve
that. Right,
you
yes.
preserve your duck in the duck fat. But you can do it with vegetables as well. And garlic is wonderful when you use as confit.
Wow.
We're talking with one of WPR's in-house foodies right now, getting inspired with garlic right now, all kinds of garlic scapes, green garlic bulbs. And Lori, here's one delicious recipe that you've shared with us, garlic salad dressing, which is a lovely way to go. You get your veggies, you get your garlic. Share what's in this one.
This, again, so simple. You take a couple of cloves of garlic, about a cup of extra virgin olive oil, your favorite vinegar, red wine vinegar is a good one for this, a large egg yolk, a little bit of sugar, just a little bit of mustard, salt and pepper, throw it in the blender, blitz it for 60 seconds, and you've got something that's a step up from your basic vinaigrette, but really isn't that much more difficult. I love making my own dressings, but after a while, you want something other than just a basic vinaigrette. And knowing how crazy we are about ranch dressing in this state, I think creamy garlic vinaigrette is a really good compromise.
Might be good with cheese curds.
Actually, it would be phenomenal with cheese curds.
You can bring that in next week for us to try.
Oh, thank you. I know what I'm making for a snack this weekend. Perfect.
Well, we have that recipe, by the way, up on the Central Time Facebook page. If you try it with some fried cheese curds, let us know. Snap a picture or bring it by the office next week, something like that. Well, Laura, you didn't just stick with things that were, you know, kind of safe, like the ranch dressing, step up. You went a little nuts. You went with garlic ice cream, which is a little exotic.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Make the case for garlic ice cream.
When you want something to end your meal, but you don't want to go over the board sweet, that is one perfect place to put garlic ice cream. I was basically working with a simple vanilla custard into which I put a couple of heads of roasted garlic.
Yeah. Wait, so that's
what? A lot of garlic.
12, 15 cloves?
That explains a lot.
It was about 3 tablespoons of garlic paste. So yeah, about 15 cloves worth. And a little bit of sugar.
It's very aromatic. You made some for us earlier, and it definitely has a garlic smell to it.
You smelled it before you tasted it.
As I mentioned to our coworkers as they were trying it, this is not something you're going to want to eat a large bowl of. This is when you want a little something. But the pungency of the garlic, and of course, when you roast it, it does pull some of the strength of the garlic back a bit. It does make it sweeter. When you've got the pungency of the garlic with the creaminess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I would agree with that.
You know, yeah. I mean, think about fettuccine Alfredo. That's garlic and cream. That's just warm. In this case, you've got garlic ice cream. It's cold. You've got that as a possibility as a dessert. Some people did suggest you could make a sundae with it by using a more savory topping like salted caramel or cinnamon chipotle chocolate.
Oh, that's a cool idea. That makes sense. I could see that. Yeah.
But then you've also got this as an option to play with savory foods. Somebody suggested that we use it for a roasted veggie salad. Specifically, he said roasted beets with a little dollop of garlic ice cream in the middle of the plate would be a really good idea. Inside a half of a tomato or half of a honeydew melon, you could put your garlic ice cream in. Scoop a little bit of melon and a little bit of ice cream.
Yeah.
And
but you're not going to put it on a sugar cone. That's all I'm telling you. Based on my experience with it, I would not want to do that.
Probably not. It's probably not something that you're going to be licking slowly throughout the afternoon. You want to concentrate on this flavor and have just a little. I don't think there's enough. I don't think you can put enough on a sugar cone to make it work.
Well, we're talking to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about how to incorporate garlic into our summer cooking.
And we're taking your calls on this. What is your favorite way to use garlic? Do you have questions about how to cook with garlic? Are you a garlic fan? Do you have a favorite garlicky dish? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And tell us what you think about this notion of garlic ice cream.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion about garlic now with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton.
And we're taking your calls, too. What's your favorite garlicky dish? How do you use garlic to jazz up your recipes? What do you think about that idea of garlic ice cream? We'd love to hear what you think about garlic today and your suggestions for garlic recipes. You can call us at 800-642-1234. Or you can post to the Central Time Facebook page. Let's go to the phones right now with Paul from Madison. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
No, thank you very much.
What's your garlic story today?
My brother-in-law attended cooking school and came up with this fantastic idea, which I really enjoy making. And it's an orange and onion and garlic salad.
Wow.
Put it in a nice clear bowl. Mix up your oranges, maybe some grapefruits, but citrus, some Bermuda onions sliced up with that, and a whole bunch of sliced garlic. And you can serve it just as is, or maybe a little bit of grass, a little sugar, if they're like grapefruits, a little tart. That's it. It's fantastic.
Wow. So when you were first served this up, were you afraid of it, or was it interesting to you from the very beginning?
Oh, no. Orange and onion, no. And garlic, no. No. It reminded me sort of you know, mom with peaches and cottage cheese and the curdle. Yeah.
Okay. And what do you usually serve alongside of this? What does this accompany?
So we have it for normal picnic fare. So it'd be brats, burgers, what have you.
Wow. Orange, onion, and garlic salad.
It sounds amazing. I'm assuming that you make this a couple of hours ahead of time and the onion sort of mellows a bit. So does the garlic?
Yeah. Yeah, and generally you want to use, you know, a pretty sweet onion. You don't want to get in there and, you know, blow your sinuses apart.
I don't know.
Or
summer cold, you might have to.
Yeah.
Oh, I like the sound of that.
All right,
well, Paul, thanks for
Paul.
That call. We appreciate it.
Yeah, we're going to go next to Barbara. Barbara joins us from Madison. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I love the conversation about garlic. Garlic is one of my favorite things to put in almost every dish.
What do you like to put it in?
I put it in everything. I'm a chef, so I do cook a lot of Mediterranean food. So it's the basis of things. But I wanted to say that because I teach cooking classes, a lot of people, because they don't have the instruments that make using garlic easier, like the garlic ricer or the garlic crusher, just getting a knife and chopping it up seems unwieldy for them. So I have a suggestion.
Okay.
I take a whole bunch of garlic cloves and I put them in the food processor and I whiz them up. And then I keep that in the refrigerator and just use it, you know, usually use it up within 3 or 4 days and then do it again. But it makes putting the garlic in the dish so much easier.
And Barbara, how long would it keep in the fridge like that, do you think?
Oh, a week.
Yeah, it is kind of onerous. I agree. When you have to peel the garlic and chop the garlic, it can get old, even though I love garlic.
Although I don't like those garlic presses. I've heard from some chefs that they can actually, because of the way you press it, they can actually play up the odorous, the sulfurous compounds. So I love your suggestion. Get a lot of them done all at once, blitz them in the food processor, and you're good to go. Great idea.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're talking about garlic. If you have some ideas you'd like to share with us, go ahead and do that. But right now, let's go to Deborah from Brown Deer. Deborah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Well, I want to say I often let a little segment of garlic dissolve in my mouth, so I wouldn't have to add it to the ice cream. I'd just have to eat the ice cream. But
right.
I was telling the producer that this would be a recipe with garlic to use in your garden, and I Googled it while I was waiting, and it came up on Birds in Bloom magazine. Pairing roses with garlic doesn't sound like a match made in heaven, does it? But it really is. Garlic protects roses from not only bad bugs, it can also help prevent fungal diseases. Aphids don't love garlic. In fact, they hate it. Ants and snails aren't huge fans of garlic either. In addition, studies show that garlic has antifungal properties, which help keep fungal diseases like black spot at bay.
Wow, Deborah, thanks for that. So garlic, not only can you eat it, but it also protects things.
That may explain why I've never been able to grow roses in my backyard. I've never grown roses and garlic simultaneously. May have to give that a try.
It. Give it a try. And we're going to go to Nick now. Nick emails, what is the best, he thinks the best use for garlic is always pizza. I've got a recipe for buffalo chickpea pizza with white garlic sauce, and it's my favorite. This is kind of yummy. And Lori, what about garlic on pizza? How do you like it?
You really have to ask me that?
See, I think there's two ways to go here. You could say in the sauce, or then there's the giant cloves on the pizza.
I say yes.
To both. All of the above.
Yeah. One thing that I love using roasted garlic for on a pizza is mix it up with a little olive oil and brush that on the crust, especially if you go to the edges of the crust. That's a lovely place to find an unexpected pop of garlic.
That's a great idea.
But yeah, I'll take it in the sauce. I'll take it sliced on top. This time of year, I wouldn't be surprised to see some chopped garlic scapes on top of a pizza, especially if you're one of those really ambitious people that grills their pizza outdoors. Mm. I think garlic scapes on a pizza would be amazing.
That seems like a cool idea, and it would look healthier for some reason or another, because the scapes look more healthy, right?
Like a salad green.
Yeah, exactly.
This
lovely
bright color against all that red.
Yeah. That's cool.
Absolutely.
Well, let's go to the phones again. Seth from Madison, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, hi. Thanks. So my wife has taught me how to marinate like a skirt steak or something, and then I put it on the grill. And we use olive oil and then maybe lime juice, I think, and garlic chopped pretty small but not tiny and crushed. And then a bunch of other spices she puts in there. I don't really know what she does. And then it looks beautiful. It sits around for several hours, and then I put it on the grill, and all the garlic just falls right through the grates. So is there some way to save that? It's such a loss.
Have you ever tried making a marinade with garlic powder? Not garlic salt, garlic powder.
Oh, well, this is garlic powder? No, then it would just stick on there, I suppose.
I think you'd have a better chance of it sticking on there. Of course, there you might run the risk of, depending on how hot you're grilling, that may burn a little. But I think that would actually contribute to some of the fun char
now,
that's going on.
Is there any benefit to running that through a blender before you use it? I mean, would that help keep it from falling off?
Or? Actually, no, because my experience with garlic is when you chop it, and then you put it into, if you're talking a marinade, you've probably got an acid in there, a vinegar, or, as you say, lime juice. That is going to do a little bit of taming down of the garlic flavor. It's not going to be as sharp. So if you're noticing you've got no garlic flavor, what you might try is either garlic powder in the marinade, or you might try a different kind of marinade. There are a number of dairy-based condiments like tzatziki or raita, where you've got yogurt and garlic, or something I found out about researching the show is something called toum, which is Lebanese, where you're basically emulsifying about 3 to 5 heads of garlic with a lot of olive oil. You blitz it in the food processor for several minutes, and it comes out looking like a fluffy cloud. This is what you use to marinate your shawarma. So if you are marinating in something that is dairy-based, that might also help.
Okay. Well, Lori, thanks so much for being with us today. This was an interesting discussion.
Absolutely, and very, very fragrant.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies and a Food Friday regular. She was with us to talk about how to use garlic to spice up our summer cooking.
And don't forget, we've got recipes for that garlic ice cream and creamy garlic dressing. Also, I think a video of WPR people eating some of this garlic stuff up on the Central Time Facebook page.
Really? Are you serious?
Yep.
Oh, boy.
I am indeed. In news from NPR this week, apparently some listeners tuned in for the quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and found themselves face-to-face with the apocalypse, or Kim Kardashian, rather, whose interview on the show was kind of like the apocalypse for some listeners. Here's the beginning of that interview.
Hello, Kim Kardashian. Welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
How are you?
I'm doing well. So the first thing I want to do, and I know you're here to talk about your book about selfies, but the first thing I want to do is, I think the biggest thing in your life, I hear that you and your husband, Kanye West, are expecting your second child, and can the reports be confirmed? Is it a boy?
We actually haven't told anyone the sex. So I heard that we're having a boy, I heard that we're having twins, I heard that I'm not even carrying my own baby, I've heard so many things, and most of the information is not true.
Well, NPR got hundreds of comments about the reality star who weren't crazy about Kim being on the air, to put it mildly. In case you somehow managed not to know, Kim Kardashian is a reality TV star, wife of singer Kanye West, and the head of a media empire.
Reading what people said was kind of crazy. People said it was so misguided and offensive, I fear I will never be able to listen again. My first impulse was to question the meaning of life.
Yes, and another comment, I think 3 horsemen of the apocalypse are now fully mounted. I guess maybe some people liked hearing her, but they probably didn't take time to get in touch. They were probably too busy taking selfies or something like that.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. This is Central Time.